like to convene the February 25th, 2014 meeting of the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources. We're in session. Good morning to all of you. We have a public hearing this morning and an informational meeting thereafter. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1555A. And Beth, could you please tell us a little bit about this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1555A would cap the amount of bonds or other securities required of bidders or a purchaser in connection with a forest product sale by the state forester to not more than $500,000. It also limits the time to no later than 180 days for the state forester to return unexpended amounts from a performance bond or other security after the completion of operations. There's no revenue impact and a minimum fiscal impact.
Thank you very much. And I see we have Senator Girod, one of the bill's sponsors, with us. And Senator, welcome to our committee. I don't know if you have anyone else that you were bringing up with you.
These people are all going to want to testify, so
okay.
Jen might want to come up.
Okay. Very good. Welcome to our committee.
Well, thank you, Chair Witt, and thanks to the rest of the committee. I'm Senator Fred Girod. I represent Senate District 9, which is the rural parts of Clackamas, Marion, and Linn counties. Very heavily dependent on timber. So this started out as kind of a timber bill, but it ended up something that everybody jumped on board with because it's so specific. And all we're trying to do here is to cap the size of the insurance bond that is required for timber sales in the state of Oregon. Now, that has the good part for the state is by capping that, then more money would go into the bid itself, and which would mean more money for school funds and counties and the state. I was involved, but Jen here did most of the legwork, and so I'll let her explain the bill in a little bit more detail on what they went into and how they came up with this solution. There was no opposition in the Senate, and it's a very narrow focus, and I think it's something that everybody can agree on. I wish it was cormorants, but it's not, but it's it does have to deal with timber sales.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I work as a policy analyst for the Senate Republican office. I'm here today testifying in support of this bill on behalf of Senator Girod and of his constituents, and thank you again for the opportunity to testify today. I believe that, like Senator Girod said, that the proposal in front of you would benefit communities across Oregon. This bill would simply cap state timber sale bonds at $500,000, which is the amount that BLM timber sale bonds are capped at. And currently, Oregon's timber sale bonds can exceed $1 million. So this would essentially cap it at half of that and free up some of that capital that could be tied up for up to 6 months. Like Senator Girod said, that money is incorporated into the bond price and or into the bid price. And so the hope is, and I think that Department of Forestry would probably agree, that in capping this amount, you free up some of that money to go into the bid, to do the sealed bid process in the state. And that translates into more dollars for the common school funds and to timber dependent counties. So I think that's essentially the bill. I urge the committee to support Senate Bill 1555, and I'm available if you have any questions.
Well, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. Committee members, do we have any questions or comments? Perhaps for you, Jenny, is there any, just for the public record, is there any reason that the public's assets might be jeopardized because of this reduction?
Let me take that. Because of the size of the bond and the size of the companies making the bid, I think the answer is no. But the Department of Forestry is here to answer that question.
Okay, very good.
Because that's the question that needs to be asked.
Yes, very good. Thank you so much. Representative Clem.
Yes, thank you, Chair Witt. I just was reading the bill, and I'm wondering how you got it out 30-0 with this line definitively giving you the right to own a raccoon on line 30. Page 2, line 36.
Well, as you know, I belong to the RDL, the Raccoon Defense League.
So. Oh, my. Are we going to be imposing fees on raccoons?
I think we should tax that.
With that, thank you both. Oh, excuse me, Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Witt. I'm just curious if you have any sort of range of money that you expect it will be able to go to the Common School Fund or coming in at that particular time.
If you take a million, if they would have had to put $1 million bond in, then that money that would be between $500,000 and $1 million, that's an expense to the company making the bid. The question is, how much of that's going to go into the bid? And I would guess probably 80% of it, or maybe even more. So it isn't going to make huge differences, but it will make a small amount of differences. And the fact that there are some counties that anything that we can do to help is what we're trying to achieve here.
Any bit indeed. Follow-up,
please.
But overall, I mean, I'm not talking about, obviously you're talking about more than one or two bids. We're talking about more. What, do you have any sort of range there?
But it would be the winning bid.
Okay. So no, I mean, for all the kinds of bids that we're talking about. How many?
This is only on state forest land.
So okay.
This is not a huge bill.
Just curious. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Anything further? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Ed DeBlander. And I don't know if you have anyone else that you'd like to bring up with you, but please feel free. Chris? Good morning and welcome to you both.
Thank you. So, Chair Witt, members of the board, my name is Ed DeBlander. I'm with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm the Asset Unit Manager for the State Forest Division. ODF has evaluated Senate Bill 1555A, and the provisions are workable for ODF. Bill proposes to do three things. It caps performance bonds and bid bonds at $500,000 each. And then the third thing that it does is it requires that performance bonds be held for no longer than 180 days following the timber sale contract completion. Current practice for ODF is to require performance bonds at 20% of the bid value of each sale. And under this formula, about 80% of sales actually would require less than or equal to $500,000 performance bonds today. And so we have the other 20% of the sales, basically the larger sales. ODF acquires a little bit of extra risk because the performance bonds would be lower. However, we totally agree that the bonds actually cost the purchasers to purchase, and so the higher amounts would have higher costs, and so there is definitely an opportunity for increased bid prices on these sales. And we believe that risk that we acquire is actually quite low because we're talking about the larger sales, and those are almost always purchased by the more solid purchasers, larger purchasers in our purchaser pool. So this bill also caps bid bonds at $500,000, and this actually has almost no impact. I think over the history of our sales, we've only had two or three sales that required more than $500,000 bid bond. So this already aligns really well with our current practices. The third provision is the provision that requires ODF to hold performance bonds no longer than 180 days following the termination of a timber sale. And this is consistent, also consistent with our current practices, and this also aligns with ORS 279C.605. This statute allows any person that is providing labor or materials on a state contract, it gives them 180 days to make a claim against the performance bond. So it lines up really well. So anyway, I appreciate the opportunity to provide this testimony and would like to thank Senator Girard for working with us in its crafting. So with that.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, good morning, members. Chris Jarmer, Oregon Forest Industries Council. We'd just like to throw our support for 1555 for your attention. Also like to thank Senator Girard and you for hearing the bill. Appreciate that. If I could answer Representative Frederick's question, I just throwing out some numbers, if you saved $40,000 on a bond and it was 10 sales, that'd be $400,000. I mean, I think that's the range that you're talking about. So, and I, too, would entertain any questions that you might have from the purchaser's perspective.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? Mr. DeBlander, I do believe that you answer my question, but I, for the purpose of the record, I want to ask you very directly, is there any reason to think that this bill would in any way jeopardize the public's assets?
I think it's highly unlikely.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Anything further, committee members? I'm seeing none. Thank you both very, very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 1555A this morning? Last and final call. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1555A and open a work session on Senate Bill 1555A. Like to recognize, please, Vice Chair Frederick.
Chair Witt, I move Senate Bill 1555A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Frederick moves Senate Bill 1555A to the House floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion? I'm seeing none. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative
Reardon. Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Unger.
Aye.
Representative Whipset.
Aye.
Vice Chair Escobel.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Chair Witz.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes. I see, Representative Krieger, that your name appears on the bill. Would you like to carry it? Thank you very much. Representative Krieger will be our carrier, and with that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1555A. Thank you, everyone. That moves us to the informational portion of our meeting. I'm going to open an informational hearing on the impacts of the Coal Creek wildfire. And with that, I'd like to call up, please, the Oregon Department of Forestry.
Good morning.
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. All right. For the record, good morning. My name is Doug Decker. I serve as Oregon State Forester, the director of the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm pleased to be here with this team today to fulfill a request that stems from the 2013 session related to House Bill 3109 and the Coal Creek Fire, which burned about 26,000 acres outside of Sisters in all on national forest land in 2012. The fire was, you may remember, it was in the news then for a variety of reasons. Smoke impacts, smoked out Sisters, folks moved out of town for a couple of weeks, some people did. Dramatic fire behavior, very intense heat and combustion due to the flammable fuel types associated with the fire, ongoing issues around air quality. And really, the impetus for taking on the work that we're going to share with you this morning is due to the leadership of Representative Gene Wisnett from Central Oregon and Chair Witt, who I think really recognized the long-term impacts of fire and who asked us to look deeper into how fire affects public health and how it affects fish and wildlife habitat. And so the presentation you'll hear this morning is the story of that inquiry. As you hear from our fire and our forest scientists and our public health experts, I ask that you listen to the common theme here, which relates to the last time I appeared before you, that there's been some fundamental shifts in forest management policy and in federal budget and federal funding capacity for fire and for forest management that are producing an unhealthy and undesirable suite of consequences that increasingly are coming to characterize large fire in Oregon and particularly on federal land. We are having more large fires that are resulting from greater buildups of unhealthy forest conditions, and really it's not simply enough to look at the costs of fighting fire, which we know from this last season are devastating, but we have to look deeper at the impacts, the basic impacts to human health, to air quality, to water quality, fish and wildlife habitat, and really also at the underlying productivity of the soil to really understand the true toll that large fires are taking in Oregon. I think you're going to find this material here thought-provoking and very relevant to the current and the future discussions that we have about fire and about federal forest policy change here in Oregon and across the West. So I'm pleased to introduce Nancy Hirsch, who's ODF's Chief of Fire, who will be introducing the panel here this morning. Thank you, Chair Witt.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Witt, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Hirsch, Fire Protection Division Chief for Oregon Department of Forestry. Doug has covered quite nicely the legislation and the requirements that offered the opportunity, really, for us to work closely with Oregon Health Authority. I want to just add one component, and that is that the legislation's primary purpose seeks to increase public awareness of the effects of wildfires and to offer recommendations for reducing impacts. As I've said, we appreciated the opportunity to work not only with Oregon Health Authority, but it meant for both of our agencies doing some outreach with other sister agencies, working as well with the U.S. Forest Service, and also had the opportunity to work a little more closely with bill sponsors, so we appreciate that. The panel today will include Curtis Coode to my left. He's the Environmental Public Health Section Manager, and he has available David Ferrer, the Public Health Toxicologist, just right behind me, to help address any questions that any of you may have. Teresa Alcock has just joined us. She's also with the Department of Forestry, and she's the Fire Program Analyst. She will present the impacts on forest and stream habitats, and then I will wrap up along with Curtis talking about the recommendations that we have that the bill provided us the opportunity to address as well. So first, I want to address or provide for you just a little bit of context. We'll start there. I kind of just walked through the contents that we're going to cover. So I'm going to move here to some basic geography for context. The Pole Creek Fire occurred about 6 miles to the southwest of Sisters. This is about 20 miles northwest of Bend. On this map, you can see a yellow line, most significantly there running kind of north to south on the left-hand side. On this map, it shows the boundaries of the Sisters Community Wildfire Protection Plan, where residents have homes adjacent to wildland areas. It also represents their community wildfire protection plan within their wildland-urban interface. Sisters is very progressive with their protection plans, and I think you'll understand why here in just a moment when I show you some more context. The map also shows public and private lands. You can see the private land there is a very large block that ran parallel to the east flank of this fire, and then also the checkerboard ownership here on the north end. That meant that while this fire did not impact ODF-protected lands specifically, ODF was engaged and involved in this fire, coordinating with the interagency management team very early in that fire to ensure that those lands were protected and that the fire, we minimized acres of any impact there.
Nancy, could you identify for us, please, the colors? It's difficult for us. It's not the map key is not clear to us here.
I think the key points that I would make on here without making it too complex is that the green ownership and the purple ownership in here is all U.S. Forest Service. And the green is delineating some late successional reserve on U.S. Forest Service ownership. And then you have a lighter green, that shows up here. Again, this is all Forest Service ownership, but it's wilderness. And then the private land that I was referring to is really the yellow here and kind of yellow-green here in the checkerboard.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Lastly, there are several streams in the watershed, including the Pool Creek, for which this fire was named. This slide shows a few facts about the Pool Creek fire, and rather than read those to you, but I would point out some significant points are made there. The bottom line here that I would like to share is that it was a devastating large fire within the Wychus watershed, which was burned severely. And, you know, if you've never been out on a wildfire during or post, you can see the significance here in terms of the severity of the burn and the problems with erosion that Teresa here will talk more about in just a few minutes. This slide really puts impacts into context. There have been several large fires in the area over the past decade, resulting in almost 200,000 acres burned on the U.S. Forest Service Sisters Ranger District. Like others, the Pool Creek fire spread rapidly in contiguous accumulated fuels. The result was a hotter and more intense fire that even killed thinned and normally fire-resilient stands of ponderosa pine. The picture here on the left depicts such a stand within the Pool Creek burn area that was treated and still burned due to the intensity of the fire coming off adjacent untreated stands. So that's, I think, all I have to offer there on context. Not a small visual there in terms of the magnitude of acres burned and the impact. So from here, we're going to turn it over to Curtis, who will begin to talk about the public health impacts.
Before we have that segue, it may be helpful to ask some questions about the fires itself. And I know you stated that there have been several large fires in the area over the past decade. Is there... would this be typical, several large fires in an area this size in a decade?
Chair Witt, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, obviously in Oregon we have wildfires every year. I would say that in this particular location in central Oregon, the impacts, the number of fires and really the acres burned are probably a little bit more significant, but I would like to follow up with you and validate that by furthering the conversation with my Forest Service counterparts. For Oregon Department of Forestry protected lands, up until the epic 2013 fire season, on the lands that we protect, we were averaging about 12,000 acres of burned forest lands each year. For the Forest Service, I know that number is significantly higher, and I can provide those for you later.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. And one is an observation that I've had. Now, this ponderosa here, how long does it take for it to start blooming when it's standing, or does it?
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Esquivel, on the blooming, you mean in terms of salvage following a fire?
Correct.
The blue stain.
I mean, the blue stain will set in if it's laying down within a year or so. How about if it's standing?
While it's standing, right now, my best recollection of that, dealing and visiting with Collins Pine, who were impacted significantly by the Berry Point fire, they were seeing blue stain on their ponderosa pine within, you know, they were attempting to salvage all of that within 4 to 6 months, but even standing and salvaging in that time frame, they were getting a reduced value in the wood.
Okay. I'll follow up.
Please.
The other thing that I observed one time up in the North John Day Wilderness was a 40,000-acre fire that was caused by lightning on Federal Forest Service land, and it was in tamarack. Tamarack is just like lodgepole. It grows like dog hair, very close. The sad part about it was that there was no salvaging whatsoever in the area other than next to the road. And what happened in the wilderness area is all this stuff starts falling. It looks like pickup sticks. We've all played pickup sticks when we were kids. And this stuff was three and a half feet in depth. Well, the rest of the forest started growing in reprod, but my problem there is that when we get a lightning strike, it's going to start that system all over again because of the amount of wood that was left on the forest floor. And what we've done is we've created a natural environment for fire to excel, and we did nothing about it. I just don't understand some of our policies. I guess this is federal land; it has nothing to do. So we do a great job, I think, in the state. But I scratched my head about the beds.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. Representative Esquivel touched on it, but talk to us about what this has been ongoing for years and years, these different fires. What type of salvage was done on those pre-burned areas, and then on this one, what is the federal government doing? Any type of post-fire rehabilitation? What have they done to protect the streams? So many of the regulations that we have are protect water values, and if they do nothing, and they're doing just the opposite of what they're requiring me to do on my forest land. So I'd like to know about utilizing any of that stuff. Are they just leaving it there, Representative Esquivel said, to burn again and again and again, similar to what happened on the Tillamook Forest, until we finally went in and cleaned it completely up? And kind of contrast what they've done to what would have happened had that been, let's say, state forest land or private industrial forest land.
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, you touch on a lot of important topics that actually are part of our recommendations today in terms of some activities or perhaps less activity on federal forest lands. I don't know if Teresa knows more specifically because she did a lot of the in-depth research with the sisters district. To my knowledge, I'm pretty familiar here with where the Pole Creek fire is located and spend a lot of personal time out there recreating, and I'm not aware of any significant salvage of any kind that has occurred here, for that matter, on other fires that happened in 2012.
Mr. Chair, I would confirm that. The B&B fire. If the committee members have been to Central Oregon, you go over Santa Ana Pass and you'll see the B&B fire, and none of that was salvaged because of lawsuits.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
I'd just add to it, maybe address the last part of Representative Krieger's question in terms of if this were state forest land. The state forest lands that the Department of Forestry manages does provide mechanisms in order for us to provide a timely response in a post-fire situation. This summer would be an example. As a result of the Douglas Complex, we had some state forests, both Board of Forestry and Common School Forest Land, impacted by those fires, and that salvage is already underway, as well as any restoration efforts needed to be done.
Representative Whitsitt.
I just wanted to confirm the same thing with the Berry Point fire. Isn't that correct, that they haven't had any substantial cutting of any of the trees, and most of it is blued and no one wants it now?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, appreciate you adding that on. Of course, Berry Point was a very large fire that we're going to be talking about later this afternoon in a Senate committee. on that fire, this is where Collins Pine lost over 40,000 acres of forest land, but much more of that was on Forest Service, and to date there's been no post-fire salvage and very limited even roadside salvage in terms of providing a safety corridor.
Representative Krieger.
Just one more.
Yeah.
I just got a paper the other day and it basically is talking about EPA and all these others questioning the adequacy of the Forest Practices Act to protect watersheds for salmon and all this. It seems ironic that the federal government is questioning what we're doing. If they want to question something, let's take a look at the forest management of the federal government, which is non-existent. And the, not only does that not provide any type of economic value from the timber that's there, but in fact it degrades, not for just a few years, but for decades possibly, water quality, fish habitat, and it's deplorable what the federal government does, or lacks doing, while they sit here and point their finger at us. We're doing the very best we can of being good stewards of the land. The federal government is the poorest stewards of the land anywhere in the world. They don't even allow this kind of mucky business in any of the European fires when they burn.
Thank you, Representative Krieger. I was going to ask a question. I lost my train of thought. I know. Are you aware of a federal policy that precludes any kind of salvage or restoration after a major forest fire?
Chair Witt, specifically, I believe that their plans allow for post-fire salvage.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, the planning processes associated with their processes end up resulting in, if in fact they choose to put funding, if they have funding, and or capacity into post-fire salvage, it's typically well beyond the point of any economic return. But even with that, I think you can see the trends here in Oregon, whether it's the Biscuit Fire or the B&B Fire that Representative Wisnett was speaking to, or the Berry Point Fire, that there really isn't, there doesn't appear to be a priority on post-fire salvage and restoration.
So it's more a matter of priorities, so to speak, than it is of policy.
Chair Witt, I think our federal counterparts would specifically add, for them, it's also about capacity and funding.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Representative Witsit?
Yes. I'd just like to mention to the committee, a year ago, we heard testimony in this committee from regarding the Berry Point Fire and from the federal government that they were working on allowing this Berry Point to be logged, basically. And as it turns out, what happens, it keeps getting pushed out further and further till the logs are blued, mm-hmm. and then there is no value to them at all. So we heard people come a year ago right before us and say, yes, we're working on this, we think we're going to get this done, and nothing, you know, basically nothing happened. So just for the record.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I apologize if we got the flow of your presentation off kilter, but please proceed.
Appreciated the discussion. I think it's right in line with, we'll continue to build on those themes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. So considering impacts to public health, Oregon Health Authority found, first of all, there are no reported direct injuries.
Would you please identify yourself? Thank you.
Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Curtis Coon. I'm the Environmental Public Health Section Manager in the Center for Prevention and Health Promotion, Public Health Division, Oregon Health Authority.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So, first of all, we found there were no reported direct injuries from the fire, and that includes things like burns, inhalation of superheated gases, or carbon monoxide poisoning, things of that nature. However, the particulate or PM2.5 component of wildfire smoke is the most hazardous to health of the general public, including sensitive populations. P- PM 2.5 is associated with increased cardiac events, including fatal events, in people with pre-existing heart conditions and exacerbations of pre-existing respiratory illnesses like asthma. Sisters experienced several days of PM 2.5 in the hazardous range during the Pole Creek fire. You'll see that in the dark, almost brown area. In Bend, PM 2.5 only hit unhealthy for sensitive groups a couple of days and was in the moderate to good range throughout the rest of the fire period. So again, hazardous is the worst air quality category possible on this scale. And unhealthy for sensitive groups is a couple of categories down in the bright red. So the Oregon Health Authority observed no difference in the number of heart-related or respiratory-related hospitalizations during the Pole Creek fire compared to the same time period the previous year when there was no fire. Hospitalizations is a somewhat crude measure because it only includes people who were admitted to the hospital. People who go to the emergency room or immediate care or regular doctor's appointments and receive treatment and go home are not captured in that particular measure. Emergency rooms and immediate care facilities are not required to report smoke-related illnesses to Oregon Health Authority. Oregon Health Authority asked emergency rooms and immediate care facilities to provide this data voluntarily. In response to this request, one facility provided data for all of the days requested, one facility provided data for some of the days, and one facility provided data for just one of the days, and the rest weren't able to provide any data. So while these data are very limited, they did not suggest an increase in heart-related or respiratory-related emergency room or immediate care visits. And we'll see a little bit more information on the next slide. Thank you. This table shows the numbers of deaths related to cardiac events and respiratory events in Deschutes County, comparing 2011 and 2012, as well as the time periods before, during, and after the Pole Creek fire. And you see the Pole Creek fire represented in that middle column there. There are more deaths related to both heart and respiratory conditions in 2012 than in 2011, during the period from September 8th to October 2nd, which was that period of the Pole Creek fire in 2012. However, the 25-day period prior to the start of the fire in 2012 saw just as many heart-related deaths as during the fire, so there's not much of a difference there. Even though there appears to be an increase in deaths related to respiratory ailments in Deschutes County during the Pole Creek fire compared to 2011 and the time periods before and after the fire in 2012, only one of these deaths was a person living in Sisters, so the area hardest hit by PM 2.5. You see that number 14 down in the middle on the last row there. The other 13 respiratory-related deaths in Deschutes County during the period of the fire in 2012 represent people who live 20 miles or more away from Sisters. The only other air quality monitor in Deschutes County at that time was in Bend, and as I mentioned earlier, the air quality in Bend was much better than in Sisters. So next slide, please. And finally, there were two smoke-related motor vehicle crashes in the Sisters area during the Pole Creek wildfire. And we know this because ODOT's accident reporting form has an option for the reporter of an accident to indicate whether the accident was related to decreased visibility from the smoke. No injuries were reported in connection with these two accidents.
Thank you.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to present testimony today. In order to put wildlife impacts into context, we can describe an area's fire characteristics with...
Hey, if I could just interrupt just for a moment, and if you'd please introduce yourself
I'm sorry.
For the record.
For the record, my name is Teresa Alcock. I'm the Fire Program Analyst at Oregon Department of Forestry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
In order to put wildlife impacts into proper context, we can describe an area's fire characteristics with fire regimes based on climate, topography, and response of vegetation to wildfire. Fire regimes help us understand the types of fires likely to happen and the severity of impacts we might expect. The map here shows fire severity classes, but generally the darker the color, the more severe the fire burned. So we can see the red outline of the perimeter of the fire, and the darker family of colors shows more severe fire. So within the Pole Creek fire perimeter, as one moves up in elevation from ponderosa pine forests up through lodgepole pine, mixed conifer, and subalpine fir, there are four historic fire regimes that are defined, ranging from low to high severity and respectively high frequency to low frequency of fire. So in those red areas there, we have more frequent fires but less intense or less severe fires. And in the on the bottom left of the fire area in the blue, we'll find less frequent fires, but when they do burn, they're more severe. So in those in the blue colors that we see on the map, we're seeing higher severity fire impacts that are expected in a high severity fire regime. High severity fires modify habitat the most, where forest canopies are completely burned. We call those stand replacement fires. The red color family on the map shows lower elevation ponderosa pine forests, where historically there were frequent low-intensity fires that periodically cleared out the undergrowth. And the dominant older ponderosa pine has thick fire-resistant bark when it matures, and it is adapted to a fire environment. But what we do see is that this red area here is an area that burned at very high severities. And we're looking at the ponderosa going up into the lodgepole. And normally that would experience a low intensity but frequent fires. But we see a lot of darker red in this map. So what's important to note is that fires that occur in altered environments, such as one with fuel accumulation due to fire exclusion, a lapse in management, and insect damage, we all know about the insect problems up there with the lodgepole, may produce effects that are beyond the normal range of variability, such as larger or more severe fires or both. So, with the Pole Creek fire, we have different burn severities across the landscape. This map is showing, again, that fire severity, and we've got some other features we're going to look at next. So we have different burn severities across the landscape with variable fire impacts. But 39% of the burn area was high severity and considered stand replacement. That would be beyond the normal range of variability in this area. This map also shows sensitive streamside or riparian areas as identified by the Westwide Wildfire Risk Assessment. This was a report done recently by the Oregon Department of Forestry and the Western State Council of Foresters and delivered to us this year. So what we see are in purple those streams that are considered sensitive areas from the Westwide Wildfire Risk Assessment. So we can see the darker areas of the severity of the fire covered a lot of the headwaters of these streams. Now, some fire impacts are beneficial and some are detrimental. Severe forest stand replacement fires reduce habitat for species that require canopy cover, but improve habitat for species that prefer open spaces.
Could I interrupt here for a moment, please? You've focused our attention on some of the water sources and said that they are in sensitive areas. Could you tell us why they're sensitive?
The Westwide Wildfire Risk Assessment Project was a multi-year project, and it was 17 states in the West that got together and mapped wildfire risk for all of our states. And the riparian areas were created based on attributes of water quality, water quantity, and ecological significance. And so what the Council of Western States Foresters and Oregon Department of Forestry did was gather hydrologists and so forth and experts in hydrography and hydrology from each of the 17 states and consulted with them to assign a ranking process to each of the streams. And so this is the Oregon version of that.
Thank you very much.
We've referenced the Westwide Wildfire Risk Assessment Project in our references cited in the full report. So 39% of the burn area was high severity and considered stand replacement. Many of this area was in streamside areas or sensitive areas, headwaters of some of these streams. Though species adapt to survive their historic fire regime, abrupt habitat changes, like a severe disturbance such as wildfire, will influence the wildlife, such as movements of communities after fire, to find alternative cover and forage habitat. So among the greatest impacts, we're looking at a loss of interior older forest habitat and connectivity loss. Remember the first slide, we saw a map of the area that showed the Forest Service's late successional reserves. Those were hit pretty hard in this fire. And the spotted owl has marginal habitat in those late successional reserve areas, but there is a loss of potential canopy habitat for those. We have an increase in open canopy habitats. A big game will benefit. Deer and elk and so forth go to open areas for fresh browse and fresh forage. With the loss of forest canopy, there's potential for reduced precipitation reception and earlier snowpack melting. So this means lower live fuel moistures over time, especially in drought conditions. And so it's going to be really important in predicting future fire behavior on those live fuel moistures, and we want to make sure we have canopy there that can receive the precipitation and store it. 26% of the fire area is susceptible to a moderate to high soil erosion hazard, and so that's going to have some impacts on erosion, sedimentation in the streams, and so forth, which will be addressed on the next slide. Soil burn, it's going to be very important because the loss of soil cover and soil burn will impact the primary food web. Many of the species are mobile. They can move away from the fire area, but some of the species, the macroinvertebrates and so forth, in the primary food web that live in the soils, especially streamside, they're not very mobile, and so they will be impacted. With standing dead snags, raptors and woodpeckers will benefit. Those cavity nesters and the insect eaters will benefit. So in terms of the fish, there was no direct fish mortality observed, but we are going to see, with the loss of canopy cover, especially along the stream sides, an increase in stream water temperatures, which means a potential surge in that primary productivity along the stream and within stream. You're going to have a lot more sunlight hitting the stream, the temperature's going to raise, and you're going to get algal growth and those kinds of things, so a surge in that productivity. We're going to see some, we already saw a photo of mass erosive effects. We saw Pole Creek Spring there that was completely burned, and you could see it's just mucky and muddy in that spring area, and all that is going to be washing down as erosion and sedimentation in the streams. So we are going to see a degradation of water quality with those increased sediments and some chemical changes because of that as well. So as the Forest Service continues monitoring after the Pole Creek fire, we're going to expect to see some data on these effects. So we've got all the ingredients. We've got historic fire exclusion, a lack of active management, extensive acreages of the insect-killed lodgepole pine. Granted, the lodgepole pine was at the end of its lifespan up in the higher elevation areas up in there, but still a lot of standing dead fuels. We've got cumulus contiguous accumulated fuels, and then with drought stress, we've got an invitation to more insects and disease. Here comes the vicious cycle, which means greater intensity fires, an increase of the size of fires, more smoke, and more severe effects. Now we can look at some recommendations.
Thank you. So following the Pole Creek fire, Oregon Health Authority collaborated with forestry, DEQ, U.S. Forest Service, Oregon OSHA, local health departments, and others to develop an interagency protocol. I believe you have that with you. And that guides government response to severe wildfire smoke episodes. Oregon Health Authority encourages local communities to use this protocol in responding to such events in the future. After each fire season, the same agencies that created the protocol, plus any additional agencies that want to be involved, gather to update and refine the protocol based on recent experience. And I think that this was a direct result of the Pole Creek fire in that season. So it was a great opportunity. It was difficult to get information, as I mentioned, about emergency department visits and immediate care facility visits related to wildfire smoke. There is no requirement for emergency departments to provide Oregon Health Authority with this type of information. Oregon Essence is an automated electronic data reporting system that's now available. If all hospitals used Essence, the kind of information that we needed would have been made readily available without placing any additional burden on the hospitals because it is an automated system. This would have allowed Oregon Health Authority to track emergency department visit information and would have given Oregon Health Authority a better opportunity to respond to the public health effects of the wildfire. So we recommend is that we encourage all hospitals in Oregon to implement Oregon Essence to improve the time reporting of emergency department visits across the state.
Okay, nearing the end here of our presentation, but want to wrap up with recommendations from Department of Forestry. And I hope you captured the slide there at the end that Teresa presented. Really, it was the unfortunate recipe for disaster in the conclusions there. Our recommendations attempt to address, really, the landscape issues that we see on federal forests. The first one relates to supporting the cohesive wildfire strategy. The cohesive strategy is a national effort in response to requirements of the Federal Land Management Assistance, Management, and Enhancement Act, better known as the FLAME Act of 2009. The Wildfire Leadership Council directed the development of the cohesive strategy. It's really essentially a collaborative process and provides an excellent conversation framework. It involves really all levels of government, as well as non-governmental organizations and the public. It seeks national kind of all lands, all hands solutions to wildfire management. The cohesive strategy is focused on three goals, where all hands work to find really the sweet spot and expand that where we can to create fire-adapted communities and restore ecosystem health, which essentially we call active management, as well as implementing a safe and effective wildfire management decision. For Department of Forestry, again, this third element, response to wildfire, is directly, and you are very familiar with our objectives of minimizing, keeping fires really at the smallest possible size, minimizing cost and loss. ODF actually has one of the first funded projects in Northeast Oregon called the Blue Mountain Pilot, and we're actively seeking other funds as they become available to apply this work further and really further the work working with other partners. So lastly, instead of reading these points, I would just like to say that simply put, our call is really a call that you're making as well, as I know with the conversations you've been having here. It's really about a call for increasing active management on federal forests, proactively before fires start, and after fires with salvage and restoration work. The risk of fire occurrence and fire severity increases substantially if salvage and other fuel reduction actions are not taken in a timely manner, ultimately transferring risk to adjacent landowners, And oftentimes, those adjacent landowners are private landowners of which we provide the protection for. There's obviously a lot we could talk about here, and I know the legislature is leading on this front in many forums, all towards keeping Oregon's forests green and growing. ODF and OHA are committed to utilizing this report, as well as I believe that you also received a copy of a fact sheet, and we are committed to continuing with our communication and outreach, and all towards educating and increasing the public's awareness of the effects of wildfires. Lastly, we would like to make some acknowledgments of people that were instrumental in the production of this report that you can see here. And with that, I would just say thank you, and all of us, any one of us, would be happy to take any further questions.
Thank you very, very much. Representative Krieger.
Just going back to 2012, we had our legislative days here in September. I left, went to Pendleton, into Boise, Idaho, crossed into Jackson Hole, Wyoming to see the Tetons, which were completely covered with smoke. To get out of the smoke, I had to go to Montana. But to get home, I had to come through Idaho. Idaho was solid smoke no matter where you went. 125 miles on one road with signs saying, enter at your own risk, health hazard. You could drive 30, 40 miles, never see a car, because people left. So I'm wondering about your health. How many of the people do you think that could have been subjected to the health risk, which showed some change but not much, left that infested smoke area to avoid it? Therefore, when you look at your figures, you're not comparing apples and apples. It's the fact that if that population was the same and they'd have stayed in Sisters in those areas and been subjected to that smoke for months, those numbers would have been much higher. But they left to avoid it, so you're not. Can you address that a little bit for me?
I could probably just a little bit. Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, I know that I spent time, you know, as an example, on the Pool Creek fire and in the vicinity. And so your notion there that people definitely vacated the town, which would obviously skew the numbers, I think is a very valid one. Individuals that really are challenged with respiratory problems, you know, I visited with people in the community that said, hey, we just had to leave. The other element that I would be remiss without stating, one thing that we didn't touch on in this report, and it wasn't required, but given our experience within the Department of Forestry with the number of firefighters that we have, and when we have large fires, you know, we do have people that are being impacted daily that are basically being taken for from a health perspective within the incident management teams that are deployed. So you have folks with, you know, chronic coughs. You have people that have been exposed to carbon monoxide that can get dreary and drowsy. And so just wanted to mention that because that's an important part of, obviously, our livelihood.
Please. Back to a bill we had last year. I can't remember what the name, what it was called, but had it in judiciary, I believe. The risk, we talked about these fires being on federal land and they burn onto private land. As private landowners and even industrial, non-industrial, you don't have any recourse against the federal government. Reverse it. It starts on our land, burns on the federal. They want to sue you for everything from the birdie to the water and degradation. Can you address that?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, I believe you're speaking to the Moonlight fire of... I may forget 2007, I believe it was, of which the federal government did make suit, and there was a settlement there where Sierra Pacific not only paid a lot of money, but also turned some land, private land, over to the U.S. Forest Service. Last session in 2013, OFIC sponsored, introduced, or worked with many of you on a bill to really mitigate that risk here and strengthen the revised statutes here in Oregon.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I think we need to understand how double standard this thing has been on the civil side of it. And then you look at the ecological, the benefits of wildlife, streams, and all those things that our entire forest practice rules are put in place to protect water values, soils, and all this. On my tree farm, I got set asides 100 and some feet. I do that because I know what's best for the environment. But yet we got a federal government that's going to come after me now because I got a road that might put mud in a river. and they got tens of thousands of acres that they let burn year after year after year, dumping more material into these streams than any of us would ever think of allowing. What a bunch of two-faced people. I can't believe it.
Well, and not to upset you further, Representative, but
I'm not caring today.
I'm sure that the federal government will manage the lands that they acquired vastly better than Sierra Pacific has. Representative Esquivel with Representative Wisnett on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we're going to have the same conversation 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. It doesn't matter because the federal government doesn't do a good job with our forests. Until Oregon takes control of those forests, we're going to have the same issues. It doesn't matter what we say, what we do, we're going to have the same issues. As long as we allow the tail to wag the dog in this state, and I mean by that, by the federal government allowing people to sue them, and then the taxpayer pays them, you've created a business. As long as we allow that, we're going to have the same thing over and over and over. Right now, our forests, in my opinion, are atrocious. They're poorly managed. They're ill-managed. And the unfortunate thing is, it's our state. This belongs to the state of Oregon. It belongs to the people of the state of Oregon. And yet, we don't seem to want to go up against the federal government and take control and management of those forests. And until we do, we're going to have this conversation forever.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, thank you on behalf of myself and you. I want to thank the State Forester Decker, Nancy, Curtis, Teresa, all for the time. Committee, they accepted this responsibility without any additional funding resources for their departments because they think it's important for the people of Oregon. Really appreciate the time and effort they put into this. I agree with all my colleagues up here about forest management, but what I tried to do with this, what we tried to do with this bill is people talk about money and how you cut trees and all that, but people, I was in this district during this time, and every day in the newspaper we had the public health. So what this report I'm hoping will do is we can use this report to convince people that the biggest danger to fish, wildlife, and fish habitat is not man, is not development, it's wildfires. The data you presented today, and I wish all of my urban honorable colleagues were here to listen to this, is when you have a hot wildfire, it's going to destroy a lot of things, including fish, wildlife, and the habitat. So I really appreciate the time and effort again, and we'll continue to have some discussions. I'm going to ask them to step forward and even do a little bit more, and that I think there's a lot of good data here. I'm going to see if they can help work with us and we create a seventh grade presentation of this for the public. In the military, we always wrote our regulations for seventh grade level, and so I think we want to make this because a lot of people in this building and everyone, they can take this out to the experts and manage it, but I think we need the objective here with the Chair Witt in mind when this was to be sure the public understands the real danger and impact on public health and everything. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative. Representative Witsit.
Thank you. I'm going to suggest something that I'm sure you don't want to do, but it would be profound, and that would be to show pictures of the large ungulates that are destroyed in these fires and present them to the public so they can see what animals look like that have their hooves burned off and that are still alive and are trying to wander through these areas where the soil is so hot that they're destroyed by moving, even though they weren't destroyed by the fire. And if you would actually put pictures out there, you know, the old thing of a picture is worth a thousand words, you would really make a profound or have a profound effect or influence on people so they see that, you know, it destroys life. I mean, it's not only the vegetation, but some of the pictures from the Berry Point fire I saw grown men cry, who saw the pictures, and the men who actually saw it and went out and had to kill the animals and their domestic livestock that had their feet burned off and were still alive was one of the saddest things I've ever seen. And this is how you affect the public and, you know, let them know exactly what is happening. I mean, I appreciate your reports and everything, but you really need to let them know how devastating this is.
Appreciate that.
Thanks.
Thank you. Other members, I'm very concerned that we have what appears to be the federal government undermining the good efforts of not only all of you in our state departments, but also the Oregon Forest Practices Act. And some of the issues that have come up that I've taken notes on here during this hearing, adverse impacts from severe burns, soil erosion, adverse water quality, adverse habitat impacts, food web being destroyed, temperature increases both on the land as well as our waters, increased insects and disease, human health impacts, impacts on endangered species, and most recently crippled wildlife, and I'm sure we could go on and on and on here. Does the federal government, do you know, do they have something equivalent to the Oregon Forest Practices Act? I mean, would one expect that a federal forest plan would outlaw these kinds of outcomes? Is there any place that as a member of the public I could go to a federal document that would say it is the policy of the United States Forest Service to disallow soil erosion and adverse water quality and impacts on fish and wildlife? Do they have anything like that?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, Doug Decker, the National Forest Management Act and a kind of a family of different federal legislation attempts to deal with exactly those topics kind of at a national level. I think that the challenge is, and as I presented to you in January, the planning mechanisms and the systems and the kind of legal litigation aspect that's underneath all of that conspires against our federal partners in being able to actively manage these lands and to do what many of them know is the right thing to do and that needs to be done. But they don't have the legal flexibility, the financial capacity, the planning systems in place to be able to allow them to do that. Something that that Oregon is working very hard on that I presented to you in the middle of January was we're working to try to transform the way the Forest Service plans their activities to increase the pace and the scale. And we can do that to a certain extent, but absent the reform of some of those key policies that are included in the National Forest Management Act, the Endangered Species Act, and other kind of planning authorities for the Forest Service, we're only going to be able to get so far. So, you know, the frustration that I hear in this room is the frustration that we all share, that I share with my counterparts across the West, and that really has propelled us and in Oregon with the governor's leadership at looking at how do we change those authorities? How do we change those federal authorities so that we don't face these types of consequences? We've this morning really spoken about human health and kind of ecological impacts, you know, the financial impacts, the multiplier associated with that, whether we're talking about the volume that is squandered or lost, or if you look at just what happened in the economy of Sisters, you know, as a result of folks leaving and the economic, the tourism impacts there, by every measure, you know, we've got to change the way the federal management is able to operate on these lands.
And I appreciate that, Doug. Thank you very much. And I think it is important for us to recognize that the federal government may be hamstrung by opposing objectives. But I take a look at how the public was able to focus the Forest Service on trying to retain necessary habitat for the spotted owl and kindred endangered species. And I'm wondering if some creative folks couldn't take a lesson from that and help to focus the Forest Service more on forest health in the wake of either preventing or trying to clean up in the aftermath of forest fires, because I would think that there would be ample grounds here with the litany of items that I read off earlier to find grounds for lawsuits to better focus the federal government and the Forest Service and the BLM in preventing these very items, which are undermining forest health to the disadvantage not only of our federal forests, but of our state forests. And we saw at the outset of Ms. Hirsch's presentation the impacts that have occurred on state forests, but also multiple private forests. So maybe we just have to get a little more creative here in helping to focus the Forest Service. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I agree with what you're saying, but June 1 will be 50 years that I joined the state police to start being out in the field. The Endangered Species Act hadn't come in, the Marine Mammal Act hadn't come in, the Bird Act hadn't come in, you name the acts that didn't come in. An observation of working with it, making reports to NIMS and all these things over the years, anytime that the federal government gets involved in natural resources, any natural resource, it becomes a quagmire of bureaucracy that nobody can work their way through. You need major changes, and one of the biggest ones has been talked about. The environmental for-profit industry sues because they can make money doing it. They've got a list of things under the Endangered Species Act. They can sue from now till I'm better in the grave 100 years. They intend to do it. Our senators have done nothing about the Endangered Species Act. Who has standing to sue? If you go back and look at the original Endangered Species Act, it was never meant to be like it is today. So that's where you got to go. And until you go there, like you're saying, we can't address all these things. It's just going to be forever talking about the same thing. You got to stop it and quit making people have a motive to sue, because that doesn't help the environment. Show me where any of this has helped the environment. It hasn't. All of the biscuit fires in my district, and part of the other complex I just burned over at Roseburg is in my district. And it's frustrating to see that. All that timber standing there rotting, going to the ground, ready for the next fire. Yet, in Curry County, we're sitting here under this public safety thing that we did, sent up there, not being able to fund a sheriff's office. Josephine County has a sheriff and a deputy. Crime's going nuts. And we have natural resources that nowhere in the world is being mismanaged as the federal land is. And we sit here twiddling our thumbs. We can't fund K through 12. We can't do the veteran programs that we want. We're not doing what we should do with community colleges, health care, you name it. No place else is this type of nonsense going on. And someone's got to have the courage at the federal level, regardless of party affiliation, to find a way to make it stop. And it's doable.
Thank you, Representative. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, are these administrative rules or are they laws that they're bucking in the Federal Forest Service? Is it some bureaucrat with their feet up on the desk in Washington, D.C. deciding what we should be doing out here in Oregon?
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Escobar. My understanding is that these are congressional authorities that have been acted by Congress, as opposed to administrative rules, kind of enacted at the agency level. I think it's probably a mix of both, but I think the ones that Representative Krieger has described are really those kind of congressional level authorities. And and we are seeking. The Board of Forestry has just adopted a very assertive set of actions to share with the delegation, and that I've shared with my colleagues around the West to try to transform those policies. So really at the congressional level.
Follow up, please. This gets right back to what I said before. As long as we allow people to sue the federal government and to pay them with taxpayer money, and it's a profit, it's profitability, because that's what those people are doing. They're suing and making money at it. We're going to be continued with this. But if we took over the management in the state of Oregon and they sued the state of Oregon, there would not be a reimbursement. Is that correct?
Chair Witt, Representative Escobar, the complexities associated with the liability and the financial side of that is something I'd want to follow up with you on directly. I think it's a complicated answer to that question. I think absent a change in the basic authorities, there's kind of goalposts that Congress has set out for the management of those lands, and absent the change in those goalposts, as a manager, given those same authorities and constrictions, we would have a difficult time. We manage about 1 million acres in Oregon. We would have a difficult time managing to reach those objectives with the legal and policy constraints that they have in place. Please.
Well, but what I'm saying is, if we conform to what we do in Oregon with our forest management, that's all I'm saying, is you don't have to restrict that. The restriction by the federal government is just lack of knowledge, I think, on a lot of their part. And the other thing that I feel very strongly about is that we live here, they don't. And the sad part about it is they're making decisions in Washington, D.C. that affect the livelihood plus the environment in the state of Oregon. And you talked about the goalposts. How well are those goalposts working?
I would say that the status quo is not acceptable, and I would also say that this work, this report, the kind of results here at Pole Creek give us another doorway to walk through, another tool, another lever, as we seek to engage the public in a broader recognition and understanding that status quo is not working. And for that, we're grateful for the impetus to move that forward.
Representative Witsit, followed by Representative Wisnett.
I want to say something that I know that you're aware of. Klamath and Lake County's precipitation is at about 20% of normal this year, and it doesn't look like it's getting any better. And maybe you could explain what we have sitting down in Lake County in the Fremont-Wyneema National Forest, right, waiting to go.
Right. Sure. I'd be glad to. Chair Witt, Representative Witsit, it's an area that we have referred to in the past as the red zone, and it's kind of the gray zone now, the dead zone. We've actually taken the Board of Forestry into that area up in the Dead Horse Lake area. It's essentially an area that has experienced some significant insect infestations that is, I would describe it as a fuel bed that's primed and ready to go with the right start. And there is a significant pocket there, and really throughout the Cascades, the map that Teresa showed earlier, there is a correlation between the footprint of those fires and the outbreak of insects and disease up and down the Cascades. So, that is an area that I've personally been into in the heat of August, and it does give you concern. You can see what the potential is.
And just one last thing. It's between 350,000 and 500,000 acres of standing dead timber, right, essentially, that's waiting to go up with the light of a match or a lightning strike or whatever this summer.
Right. Representative.
Real quick, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't see anyone in here from the governor's office. I know that you gave this briefing to the Board of Forestry, is that correct?
We have.
And do you have plans to schedule it with other committees in the Senate and the House, like Public Health or in the Senate committees? And I hope that my friends from the environmental community, lobbyists, would attend the briefing, too. I see one member came in late, but I hope that... you will continue, or do you have plans to brief other committees?
We do, Chair Witt, Representative Wissett. We are actually up this afternoon with the Senate Rural Communities Committee at 3 o'clock to provide this. We also will be rolling forward with a variety of different communications about the results of this report. You'll see it in all of the places where we communicate. I have briefed Brett Brownscombe on this, as we get ready for the 2014 fire season, the results of this work are going to help us drive the message about fire.
Thank you.
Last call for questions or comments. I want to underscore the earlier comments made by Representative Wisnett. And the fact that he and I greatly appreciate the work that the department has done in this regard, and we recognize that you did that without additional resources, or at least additional resources allocated by the legislature. We appreciate the efforts that you undertook to produce this report, and I just think this is critically important. It's not to say that we didn't expect a lot of these outcomes, but now we actually have the study that proves that stand replacement fires are an incredibly bad problem anywhere, and that my take home is that we probably need to assist the federal government in finding a better way to manage their forest lands. With that, I'm going to close the informational hearing. Thank you all very, very much for your testimony. Committee members, for the good of the order, Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes, just wanted to remind everyone that tomorrow night at the mill, we're going to have our National Sportsman's Caucus banquet. Looks like we have about 90 people so far signed up, and we only have room for 100, so we're running out of room, but we have some great drawings, we have some great auction items, and should be very good. You'll see your Sportsman's Caucus together, and you'll see all the members will be there. I believe that most everyone here is going, I think, so...
Very good. Thank you. And everyone, late breaking news, this just in, Representative Esquivel made homemade chocolate chip and oatmeal cookies over the weekend. He is expanding his baking skills. Come get them while they last in his office. First come, first serve. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
we are adjourned.
Representative.